Hi, everyone. This is Grant at Cause Artist. Welcome to the Investing in Impact podcast. On this episode, I speak with Hardika Shah, founder and CEO of Kanara Capital, on transforming lives and local economies by providing access to capital for small business entrepreneurs in India. Armed with a mission to empower the 70 million small business entrepreneurs in the country, Kanara has embarked on a journey to provide fast and flexible collateral-free business loans. Leveraging cutting-edge technology and a dedication to customer service, Kanara Capital revolutionized the lending landscape with its digital processes and doorstep assistance. Over the years, the company has disbursed more than $300 million to over 40,000 small business entrepreneurs, ushering thousands into the realm of financial inclusion. This transformative journey has not only created jobs and spurred economic growth, but has also generated over $100 million in incremental income for MSMEs across India. Before embarking on her entrepreneurial journey, Hardika honed her skills as a management consultant, working on projects for global companies across the USA, Europe, and Asia Pacific. Her passion for social impact led her to devote nearly a decade to mentoring emerging social entrepreneurs. At Kanara Capital, the mission is clear: to transform lives, livelihoods, and local economies by providing access to capital for every entrepreneur. With a vision of a financially inclusive world, Hardika and her team continue to pave the way for a brighter future for small business entrepreneurs across India. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Until next time, stay humble and stay creative.
Well, thank you so much, Hardika, for joining me today. Really excited to chat about your journey and sort of your mission and all you've sort of achieved so far in life. Before we get into Kanara Capital and everything you and the team have built so far, you know, talk about, you know, your incredible journey so far, sort of career arc, your career journey, and if you even want to start younger than that as a child and walk us through that. I guess talk us through that journey before, you know, founding Kanara Capital.
I've always been an anomaly to the rules. And since you said go as far back as I can, so let me go all the way back to the very beginning. I'm firstborn child of parents who, where my father is blind. And so growing up was very different with having a parent with disability and how, especially in Indian society, how that has always been not as accepted, as incorporated as you would expect. So that created the first anomaly. I ended up coming to the United States for my undergrad, which for a middle-class Indian female student or female in general to go to the US to do, you know, for undergraduate studies was a large anomaly, as that was an expensive undertaking and certainly one most middle class families could not afford, and neither could my parents, to be honest. But to their credit, they did the most, they put the biggest sacrifice out there. They sold their house, they sold their home to fund my education.
Wow.
So, you know, pretty big contribution and commitment and sacrifice as it comes. And then my career arc, again, I think that I was, it's a bit of an anomaly. I started at Accenture in Chicago, which really used to be called Anderson Consulting at the time. Management consulting, worked across the globe, moved from Chicago to Singapore, moved from Singapore to Sydney, and then from Sydney to San Francisco. And throughout, the anomaly there, I would say, is that I spent nearly 20 years in one company, and now the next 13 in this company, right, which is my own. So a pretty big anomaly in this day and age when you have, you know, a very different approach to work and life, right? So that's the arc to Kanara. Kanara got created, well, we started in 2011, launched in 2011, but I would say the idea was probably percolating for a little bit longer than that. And the actual, you know, the actual feet on the ground, moving to India and getting it launched happened 13 years ago.
Wow. I want to go back to, you know, your parents a little bit. And obviously, you know, the contribution and sacrifice they made is pretty incredible. Go back to that time in your life. Were you sort of aware of, like, did you guys have conversations about this? Of like, when you go to the US, are you thinking about doing that? What was that time like? Were your parents sort of all in, and or were you all in, and this was sort of a a family decision that no doubt you were going to do this? Or was there, you know, oh, can we do it? Do you really need to go halfway across the world for education? Well, and I guess, what was that sort of decision and moment like in that time?
I think that probably as most parents, you know, 16-year-old finds out that, you know, liberal arts is what she wants to do, and that's not available in India. And she's just found out that this is, you know, exactly the right fit for her, and it's all the way across the globe. Mm-hmm. Your first few reactions are like, all right, you know, I mean, you know, teenager found another new thing that they want to do.
Right.
Let's be honest, right? It was last week and, you know, painting the week after, and, you know, all of a sudden we are going to liberal arts, right? So I would say that they're probably the first several months was just letting me be and continue to figure out what it is and, you know, what are the options and all of that. And as I got more serious in understanding the requirements and needing to take various exams, including the SATs, then they realized that I was serious about it. And then we had to have some big conversations around, look, I know you're getting on this path and you're getting really excited. And I know all these brochures show up at home, all the catalogs and such from the universities or the colleges. And looking at the fee structure, it had to be an honest conversation of what that looks like. So the commitment I made, which, you know, was like, all right, let's, you know, I am keen on this. How can we do this? And I started working weekends and summers and to see if I could help contribute, which, mind you, my idea of that would have been, you know, rolled up to pocket money at best in US dollars.
Sure. Yeah.
But they saw that I was committed and was really serious about this. And like all parents, you know, one, you don't want to stop your children from dreaming, and two, education is important. As middle class kids, education is really one of the biggest, what shall we call it, you know, your biggest legacy as a parent to give to your child, right? So that's where I think that they made that decision, which really, I don't think I've understood the weight of that decision till I grew much older and appreciate, and I'm forever humbled by what they did. You know, what an incredible gift they have given.
Yeah, amazing. So let's get into Kanara Capital, I guess, its mission, sort of its vision. How did, you know, those previous 20 years working, you know, globally, you know, working with corporates, how did that prepare yourself to start Kanara Capital, and sort of what is its overall mission and vision?
Yeah, so let me start at the very top, right? If you look at small businesses globally, there is a large credit gap. Access to capital remains a challenge. Now, in India, there are 70 million small businesses. And of the 70 million, 99% are really micro enterprises. So the smallest of the small businesses, we classify them as micro, small, medium, MSME. Micro enterprises that, if I look at from annual revenue perspective, are doing maybe $150,000 to $200,000 in annual revenue. And they are essentially a large contributor to the economy. 30% mm-hmm. of India's GDP comes from these micro enterprises. And so when you look at the vastness of it, there's a large 70 million group of businesses that contribute 30% of the GDP, that employ 110 million people on one side. That's such a powerful target opportunity, because on the credit side, there's a $400 billion gap that just does not reach these small businesses. And my whole journey, I mean, Kanara, you know, you asked me about our mission. Our mission is very simple: to transform lives, livelihoods, and local economies by providing fast and flexible unsecured business loans. And this is where all of the intersections around capital access to small businesses really comes into play, because once you are able to get credit to the right people at the right time, then what you see is a domino effect, right? Most of our customers are sole proprietors. So you see them earn more income, you see them, you know, improve their family and their family priorities, right? All of us, education, healthcare, et cetera, are constant priorities. So you put, you know, you put more money out for that and you employ more people. So all of a sudden, you know, there are jobs being created at the bottom of the pyramid, and those jobs that empower other livelihoods, I mean, other families as well. So essentially you're creating this beautiful network effect by doing the smallest first step of giving capital to small businesses that are truly on the fringe of inclusion and are able to, you know, push their businesses forward.
Those numbers are pretty eye-popping. I mean, it's such a massive market. I look at the $300 million that Kanara has dispersed to 40,000 small businesses so far. By the numbers you have given, like, that's such an incredible feat already, but there is just room for an immense amount of growth and people to disperse capital and help grow. And we talk about whether it's small business, micro business, however you want to, you know, talk about it. What's sort of their relationship with credit?
Credit is, you know, as old as all of our societies, right? And there is credit and then there is formal credit. Now, formal credit has not been available to most small businesses for the longest time. And what formal credit does, you know, in all markets, one, it allows you to, you know, from a regulatory perspective, to make sure that there's fair practices, that there is no predatory lending, there is, you know, consumer protection. It allows you to build your credit history, which gives the next person a view of what, you know, character you are in terms of, you know, credit worthiness and credit capability. It allows you to establish yourself as a, you know, small growing business, right? Now, all these are things that have been hard for small businesses in India to get access to. It is changing, but ever so slowly, as you said, you know, we are putting some drops in the ocean, but the ocean is very large to solve for. But their relationship to credit is definitely existed. And I will call it what we see is what I call invisible credit. So what you have is, you know, friends and family credit. What you have is there is a whole system in India of savings / credit that has existed for a long time. And it's called a chit fund, where you create a group and a group commits a certain amount of money and that becomes your pool. And then every month somebody can bid for that pool. And depending on how many people are bidding for that pool, that's how much interest they're paying based on their individual needs, right? And so this credit exists. So there's a lot of invisible credit that most small businesses have experience with. And therefore, you know, to me, it has been a mystery why the large banks and financial institutions in India have essentially not paid enough attention to unsecured business lending, because there are enough proxies available. And yet, I mean, the capital flows have not been there. I think perhaps, you know, the market is large and everybody wants to cherry pick, and it's always easier to cherry pick when you are asked for some collateral and you can get the collateral, right? But then it creates large, in my opinion, it creates a large divide between those who have collateral and those who do not. And yet those who do not need capital to run their business just as much.
Yeah. We touched on it a little bit. That was my next question. It was really underlining the word, you know, access to credit, access to capital. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but what has been historically the hurdles of why that hasn't been sort of tapped into yet? Because, you know, usually when you hear huge markets, you know, there's somebody out there that wants to cater to a huge market. I guess so historically, maybe, you know, just since you've been, you know, studying the ecosystem and the market, what have you seen been the real sort of problems and sort of bottlenecks with the industry being, you know, matured as you guys are doing now?
Yeah, I mean, I see the problem at two levels. One is just lack of formalization. So small business in India does not necessarily maintain a perfect book of accounts. 80% is cash businesses. So there's a lot of cash movement. But how do I, you know, assess your business revenues when I don't have all of the banking you have done? All of your invoices are formal. We have manufacturing customers, for example, that will deliver the goods, deliver the parts, components into a line, right? Let's say an automaker is looking, you know, has got components coming in. They will deliver the components to the line. It goes straight into the, you know, into the making of the car. But they, all they have is a stamp seal on a goods delivery note. And that's their payment agreement, you know? And now those sorts of things in most modern markets would just not work, because how do I validate that that's real? How do I get confirmation? How do I know it got paid from a cash, non-cash perspective? The formality of business is a big hurdle. The informality of business, right, is a big hurdle. And then the second thing that I see is it's a really a business model challenge. So if you look at from a bank's perspective, the entire approach is, I've set up branches, you come into the branch, I have a 40-page application, I have no discerning application for you being a small business or a micro business or a medium business. Everybody goes through the same process. I need to fill out a large credit note, which has all of these elements that essentially become the decision part. And small businesses don't have that. They don't have audited financials. They don't have provisional financials. They don't have stock statements. They don't have that. So it's intimidating even going and approaching banks, because banks are not set up or geared to cater to them. And the processes of banks are very long. Typically, a bank loan in India could take you anywhere from 2 to 3 months. Now, if I'm a small business owner and, you know, if I have, I want a machine to increase production, or I have an order in hand and I want to get access to working capital loan, and without a certainty of certain kind that it is a 3-month process, it is a huge deterrent for me to be able to even apply, right? So those are some of the challenges at the ecosystem level that I prevent people from getting access to capital at the microenterprise end of the spectrum.
There's a lot of things there that this one thing perhaps can solve or can be a very big part of solving it. And that's just simply, you know, technology.
Exactly. And
I guess, how have you looked at technology from your lens? Again, we've talked about how massive the market is. This is the thing that can sort of scale all these sort of issues. Is sort of, now the hard part is obviously embedding technology in these millions and millions of small businesses. How do you go about doing that, right? That's such a brick by brick type of thing.
Yeah.
But how do you start to embed technology throughout this massive ecosystem?
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. Technology is definitely, you know, the breakthrough piece that that is required. Now, when I first started Kinara 13 years ago, let me just give you let me set the context, because we've all forgotten that we were pre-smartphone days. Everybody used to carry those little Nokia 8270s or whatever the number was, and feature phones. And most of our customers, you know, were on that, right? So in essence, when you talk about what it is that they needed to do to change their business, more importantly, we had to first think of how we can introduce technology to even underwrite their business. And we started the whole process of doing paperless loan processing, where we gave tablets to our field teams to collect that data. And then our systems would then calculate out a cash flow based P&L of that business, so we could assess the business. Technology then became for us an enabling element of doing, you know, loan processing and consistent loan processing.
Yep.
Now, the thing that has happened, the transformational piece that has happened, which honestly has taken India to the next level, is India has been investing in a large digital public infrastructure. Some of it was unplanned, because data became readily available or cheaper as new telcos rolled out a more market-grabbing approach, and the data prices came down. And at the same time, smartphones became cheaper. So this became a backdrop. While India started moving towards a single identity program, so similar to Social Security in the US, the program here is called Aadhaar. Everybody now, there are 1.3 billion people who have a unique identifier number with biometric. So there is complete identity clarity for every individual. that has now been expanded or is being expanded to businesses as well. So over time, we will see that business identity will also become seamless and verifiable. So when you think of underwriting or you think of, you know, how do we make sure that customers are who they are? The first layer is identity. The second layer is income verification. So what we used to do 8 years ago, going with our tablets and capturing data off the business by looking at those goods delivery notes or their paper invoices, etc., has now also shifted because there are two things that have happened. One is a large unified payment interface. So every trader today accepts money. It's seamless. It's like Apple Pay, but free. And you know, provided by a public-private partnership by the government of India. So in essence, I can now see a lot of the transactions of a small business owner coming through the banking system because they are using this interface, because everybody's on this interface. So that changes how I assess your income. So the second thing that I've moved from in the technologies enabled is the income verification. The third thing that we have built at Kinara, because we've been working with this customer segment for over a decade and have understood their journeys, their challenges, including due to macro events, we have built large AI ML models to do risk categorization and loan decisioning. So every single loan that today gets sanctioned at Kinara is done by our models, you know, seamlessly with no human intervention, no override functionality. And so you can see how technology has sort of brought everything into a box. Now, I'll give you some data points. We were talking about banks taking 3 months to do a loan application. Other financial institutions, you know, probably would take half that time or a quarter of that time. When we were operating in the seven years ago, our average turnaround time from the application to disbursement used to be 7 days. Today, we do that in 24 hours.
Wow.
And just imagine the power of that for a customer from, you know, they could be talking to us this morning and tomorrow there is money in his bank account. And all of a sudden, he's not worried about working capital. He's not worried about, you know, should he go get that machine or not while he's got new orders in hand. It changes the outcomes significantly from a decision perspective for that customer to just push his business forward.
Talk a little bit about maybe some, and look, I know there's so many, right? So it's hard to kind of to narrow down or pick and choose one or a certain story or example. But is there a certain sort of example or story you can give us of how Kinara sort of has worked, right? So far as like small shop owner, you know, Kinara sort of provides capital. They, you know, build up and they hire more. I guess sort of just some real world on the ground examples of how Kinara is working, you know, in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me so give you a little bit more context and then I'll give a few examples within that and just some numbers around it too. So
sure.
We service metro, urban, semi-urban, peri-urban areas, and we service customers that are in manufacturing, you know, component manufacturing, finished goods manufacturing, as well as trading. So your shop owners, whether they're selling food or fashion or electricals or whatever, that the frontline small businesses that you would find on any street corner. And some services business as well, like restaurant dine-ins and so on. Now, what we see is, and just to give you a bit of a profile of our customers, most of our customers are, I would say, about 60% of our customers are in American context, high school graduates. Some might have done 1 or 2 years of vocational training or, you know, especially in manufacturing tools training, right? So how to use some of the CNC machines and so on. And so from that perspective, they are not highly educated, but they certainly have, you know, an, you know, educational background to be operating machinery and so on. And then they're average is about maybe mid-30s. So they have come to business through working on the ground, working on the floor, working their way up, and at some point having the aspiration to be a business owner, pooling capital from friends, family, you know, putting the gold that perhaps the family has, the mother, the spouse, in getting a loan against it and starting their business. And this is the backdrop. On average, they earn $300 to $400 a month, and they hire 5 to 7 people. And the employees of those businesses earn probably about $80 to $120 a month, depending on their skill set. So this is the context of the customer and the customer segment we operate in. The stories I have are unbelievable. I have had people, I mean, I don't know which one to even focus on, right? But I'll talk about, since we're talking about manufacturing here for a minute, I can talk about someone who is working in, you know, allied foundry services, heat treatments and sort of, you know, breaking down metals. And this is a person who had come from a smaller village, come to an, you know, urban outpost to work in manufacturing. And at some point, the entire family, all four brothers, sold their family land so that the eldest brother could start this business that he was sure would change everything for them. And then the challenge he ran into is the partner he was working with decided to take off and left him holding the bag on the business. And he had to borrow from a local moneylender at 100% interest.
Oh, my goodness.
And so here he is. He's invested in this, you know, pretty heavy-duty foundry machinery. He has orders, but he cannot get out from under this debt service. Someone referred him to us. We were talking to him. We gave our first loan to him. Our first loan would have been probably about $8,000. And since then, he has taken multiple loans. But that changed his trajectory because he took that entire capital to pay off the moneylender. And all of a sudden, what he was servicing on our debt was, you know, significantly lower to what he had to pay the moneylender. And then he could pour it back into the business and build that business up. Let me give you the roll forward, you know, 3-4 years later. He has built a house next to where his manufacturing facility is, probably more like a shed, not a facility the way you think about it, but he's built a house. All of his three brothers have split off from his business, not because they're not friendly anymore, but they have gone off to start their own businesses.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the trajectory of this family is completely different today than what it was when we first met him.
I wanted to highlight something that you sort of mentioned about, you know, how entrepreneurs are sort of created, right? And I think the best, you could argue sort of the best, you know, entrepreneurs, not necessarily entrepreneurs, but from both sides, right? Because if you are a bank or you are a lender of money and a person has worked in the industry on the ground for a decade plus, that looks like it's a very risk adverse opportunity, because, you know, it's not risky capital you're giving to someone who has an idea, right? And has maybe not the understanding of how the market works, how things function. And so the production of entrepreneurs is interesting in this method where, you know, you're on the ground, you're working in it for, let's say, a decade plus, you're finally ready to do something. You have all the capabilities, you have all the knowledge, even it might not be traditional education, but it's a sort of a PhD in how business works, right? If you work in somewhere for 10 years, it's an incredible roadmap to say, okay, I'm going to start something. And now having the access to capital for these individuals, I think to even aspire to do it now, right? Because before, you know, it's a really huge risk for them if they have to find a way to get a loan for 100%. I mean, it's just such a stressful environment to have to go through that as being the only access to capital, let's say. But now I think you have a population that is prepared to start businesses. They understand the market. And now you have the access to capital, which has been innovated. And so you sort of are at this apex of an economy that is ready to sort of, you know, really take off. I mean, India is the fifth largest economy in the world. you know, I mean, it's sort of thriving on like a lot of parts of the world. So I just wanted to say like, that was, I thought that was really interesting the way you kind of looked at the arc of an entrepreneur in India is really interesting. And I hope we do that here in the US and in other parts around the world where, you know, a founder and entrepreneur doesn't have to be 22, 23 years old.
Yeah.
You know, they could be 43, 45, and that might be more of an ideal time, especially to, you know, to launch these sort of small businesses or these medium-sized businesses where your knowledge is so great. So just wanted to highlight that.
Absolutely. And in an economy like ours that is growing fast, as you mentioned, you know, GDP today is 6-7%. We are, you know, we will be the third largest economy by 2027, right? It is happening. And so to power that, we need the entrepreneurial spirit. We need entrepreneurs. We need people who are willing to, you know, push the growth, which is already happening. And so for that, we also need capital.
I wanted to kind of end on a couple things here. The first would be the Hervikas program. I think I pronounced it
right. Yeah.
Hervikas, yes. And sort of the role that, you know, women in India play. And, you know, obviously as a young student going to the US, you know, like you said, you were more, more looking at the liberal arts. You weren't going with the intention of going to business school. I mean, how has entrepreneurship changed in India for women? And how have you, I'm sure you talked to a lot of, you know, women entrepreneurs in India. I guess, how has that ecosystem, you know, matured over, you know, the last 20 or so years? And
yeah, and that's an area I think, you know, we have to do more work in, not just as India, to be honest, across the globe. Women entrepreneurs or women, female founders, for example, do not get the same level of capital globally, right? So India, we talked about the 70 million micro enterprises, only 10, maybe 12% of them are women owned and operated. So we have a huge gap because 50% of the population is women, and yet only 10% are, you know, women owned and operated. And I think some of them are systemic issues, you know, that largely, you know, ecosystem change has to happen. One of which is obviously support from the family and the network and so on. You know, we see a lot of what I would call in India, you know, or less, what I should say is we would like to promote more by choice entrepreneurs and not by necessity entrepreneurs. You know, the person who ends up selling quote unquote lemonade on the side of the street is often a necessity entrepreneur. And really what we want to promote with the Hervikas program is women entrepreneurs who have the capability, who want to build a true business and a small business and have aspirations to grow that. And what we have seen, and so just to give you our program specifics, one, we're trying to marry some of the challenges of women business, women-owned entrepreneurs, right? There are two types, those who already have a business, and the challenge there often is the bias in the system to give them access to capital. Mm-hmm. The expectations are different. The co-applicants and guarantors requirements and you know, the processing pieces are different. So we've completely unpacked all of that to make it simple. We promote the program. We end up giving a discount to the program, to the interest rate and the processing fee, et cetera, so that the woman entrepreneur ends up taking more back into the business as opposed to the same loan given to a male entrepreneur. So that's the idea, to push entrepreneurship in one way. The second thing we have done with the program is to then assess that, you know, how do we increase this number? Now, in our program, giving some other numbers, we've done about $85 million of disbursement under the Hervikas program. And this year, we've announced an additional $60 million that we will disperse this year through that program. So some total, $140, $150 million will be dispersed under the Hervikas program to what will end up essentially being 15,000 to 20,000 customers. And the thing that we also noticed is that women are often ready. They start with home businesses and they're ready to become more formal. And there's a huge barrier to do that. So the second part of our program, so there's a program for those who are already running businesses. And we also have now launched a product and a program for women who want to formalize their business. And for that, we are essentially giving them, you know, a holiday period. So 6 months, no interest to pay, no principal to pay. Let's get you, you know, out there and get you running the business, right?
Yeah.
In our books today, while the national average is 10% of micro enterprises are women owned and operated, we are doing essentially 15 to 17% of our customers are women customers. So we're trying to move the bar ever so slightly. And really, honestly, what that does, I mean, one of the things we've noticed is that women just hire more women. So there is a positive effect. A third of the jobs created by women entrepreneurs go to women. And you see that the payment behaviors of women entrepreneurs are far better than men entrepreneurs, right? And when they are challenged in the business, they work with you to solve for it rather than give up, because they put more at stake to make it happen.
And those same women who they hire will, you know, hopefully work there for a decade and then go off and start their own business, right? So then the sort of process continues, and that's the multiplier right there. I want to end on just, you know, the future, and I know it's you know, you have a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts to all this, but what are some of the goals and successes for the next 3 to 5 years that you would like to see Kanara achieve?
Yeah. So look, I mean, we are very proud of our journey and our ability to have withstood so many macro events and done it sustainably, profitably, and also with impact. So we have, you know, my goal, if I look out 2-3 years, is today we have created over 100,000 jobs to make that number 500,000. And that means that, you know, the impact of that through the community, through the entire other, you know, family and livelihoods around will be tremendously, you know, high into millions, hopefully. And that's, you know, that's just like a big objective. One of the other things that I'm really looking forward to, and hopefully that even won't take more than a year, is to actually disburse $1 billion. We have, you know, disbursed about 800 today. And so the billion is within reach of what we're going to do. And that's going to be a pretty big milestone for someone who's, you know, started this with a lot more idealism and having been away from India for so many years and coming back to build something from the ground up. So I'm really, you know, really looking forward to that, right? And, you know, we are very fortunate with the partners we have. One of the partners actually is the US DFC, which is essentially US government treasury, right? And they have been a great guarantee partner, lending partner for us. And that's the kind of catalytic capital around the world that we see coming up that is fueling our aspirational dreams to grow big as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about, you know, your journey and, you know, your path so far. Really, really incredible what you've accomplished, and hats off to your parents, you know, really, you know, sacrificing and taking an entrepreneurial risk of their own, if you will, right? Investing in you in a lot of ways. So pretty amazing what you've accomplished with that opportunity. Best of luck to you and the team for the next decade to come. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Grant. It was an absolute pleasure.